in another book by Brother Dennis Gillett, we have a chapter on dehydration. It's in his book, He Healeth All Thy Diseases. And this is quite a nice book and very thought-provoking. So he's got a passage here about dehydration. Dehydration is an abnormal loss of fluid from the body, and invariably the loss of fluid is accompanied by a loss of sodium chloride or salt. Sometimes there's also a loss of potassium and other chemical compounds. But salt is the substance which usually is lost in the greatest concentration through loss of water, and the effects of dehydration can be serious. The body is divided into different sections as far as bodily fluids are concerned, and each section has a proper level of water and salt to function properly. In a remarkable way, when this level is disturbed, the body works to re-establish the right level in each section by a rapid movement of water to correct any imbalance. As the chemical elements like sodium and potassium are necessary in different quantities in different sections, the process is complicated. When the loss of water is high and the compensating movement of liquid is insufficient to maintain the right balance, then the body cells become seriously dehydrated. If the condition is not treated, there results serious weight loss, as much as several pounds per day, and then a burning thirst and difficulty in swallowing. The skin becomes dry and wrinkled and the eyes become shrunken. Eventually the pulse races and the heart becomes inefficient. The kidneys cease to function properly and substances are retained in the body which should be eliminated and then pass into the bloodstream. In its worst condition, dehydration can result in heart attacks and serious renal failure, both of which may be fatal. Treatment obviously must be designed to replace the lost water and the chemical substances. But the first essential is to discover what has caused the depletion of these elements, that is, the physical circumstances which have cut off the supply of water and salt must be eliminated. As one medical authority has put it, the sailor or the desert traveller must be rescued, the vomiting infant must be cured, and the underlying disease must be treated. When the first cause has been corrected, then proper and measured amounts of water and salt can be given. Very soon the system will respond, and gradually the correct levels will be restored to the different compartments of the body. This will result in a restoration of the complicated function of the kidneys, the circulatory system, and the purification of the bloodstream. So, by the application of water and salt, there's health. The reader should have no difficulty in perceiving how dehydration can be a disease of the soul. The condition describes a life dried up, parched and withered. Lived to the full in one sense, perhaps, and yet empty in the true sense of the spiritual meaning of that word. The wandering boy in the parable of Jesus filled his belly, but he was really emaciated. It's a life of limitation, and the boundary is fixed by the clamant cry of the flesh. The vision is shortened, and the experience is earthly only. It is life lived as though this were the only world, no ear for the sounds of eternity. A life mastered by the appetite which no present satisfaction can quench. The demands of the flesh can be depraved, sensual, vulgar, but not always. Sometimes they are sophisticated and refined. There are choices high and there are choices low. But fundamentally they are on the same level, the cravings of the flesh which is never really satisfied. At the moment of achievement, it is the only thing that matters, but afterwards the feeling of dry disappointment. Sometimes it involves the prostitution of the highest powers for the lowest purposes, quickly enjoyed and then slowly despised, a dream fulfilled, a nightmare realised, the paradox of paradoxes. Busy, full, taking all, and at last having nothing but thirst and hunger, it's like drinking sea water. The power of the flesh unchecked drains the life of the very elements that were designed to make it good. Faith, hope and love. These are the water of life, and Paul puts it plainly, to live in the flesh is to mind the things of the flesh, minding the things of the flesh means, consequently, that the things of the spirit are neglected. The heart is hardened, the soul is desert. Pursuing, possessing, pretending, life becomes like a dried up pool, once a place of peace and pleasure, but now drained and deserted. This is life dehydrated. No upward look, no hope for tomorrow, no commerce without the spirit, the destiny of dust. Paul puts it plainly, the mind of the flesh is death. To the human mind, there are gradations of fleshly life. Some are popular and approved, some are shocking and deplored. But to Paul, the result is the same. The mind of the flesh is death, and it leads to death, because the essential elements that make for spiritual living are drained away and not replaced. So at last, a burning thirst which is never quenched, a vision which, rightly named, is blindness, the system of life poisoned by forces which should be shed, but which instead are retained and absorbed. And so out of this drained condition, the voice cries for help. In the words of the psalmist, my loins are filled with burning. It is the cry of a man dried and doomed by a bondage he's made for himself. It's the voice of a soul pining for some alleviation of a devouring hunger, a spirit disillusioned and disappointed. My loins are filled with burning, and there's no soundness in my flesh. The answer to this cry was heard first a long time ago in the land of Israel, up to celebration of the Feast of Tabernacles. If any man thirst, let him come unto me and drink. The Apostle tells us that this was the cry of Jesus on the last day of the feast, that is, the eighth day. And it should be understood that these words were spoken circumstantially, that is, out of the peculiar circumstances of the eighth day. Commentators tell us that during the 7 days of the Feast of Tabernacles, water was carried from the pool of Siloam, or the brook Kidron, and poured out in the temple, to signify to the worshippers two things. First, that God had answered the need of water for their forefathers in the wilderness. It was real water to quench a real thirst. And second, to remind them that their Hebrew prophets had foretold of a day to come when rivers of waters would renew and remake the barren desert so that it would blossom as a rose under the providential care of God. The real significance being the revival of the nation's spiritual life under the rule of their Messiah. The water of spiritual life for Israel. But on the eighth day, the last day of the feast, there was no carrying of water at all. And this was just as significant as the carrying of water on the previous 7 days. It was intended to remind the Hebrew worshippers that the great spiritual promise had not been fulfilled. Still they waited for the coming of the one who would give them the water which promised so much and which would renew their life. So, on the last day of the feast, when the men and women of Israel dwelt upon this lack of fulfilment, Jesus stood and cried, saying, if any man thirst, let him come unto me and drink. What he is saying is that all the sense of lack, all the realization of unfulfillment, the burning thirst, the spiritual weakness, can be met and satisfied in him. He is a man with an essential remedy for an essential need, and he cries out with a shout of God, if any man thirst, let him come unto me. Think who he is crying to. He is crying to a people broken with weariness, bereft through a threadbare religion, groping in the gloom, beset with failure, suffering from dehydration and longing for some relief. Are the words of the crying man true? If they are not, then it is the cruelest deception ever perpetrated upon a suffering generation. But there are thousands upon thousands of witnesses who would testify that, put to the trial, the words are true. He is no charlatan. He is the life-giver. That is what they say. They have found that when they were thirsty, tempest-tossed and weary, finding nothing to slake their burning desire for some relief, through this crying man, life's fitful fever was cooled. The unsuffered life in the desert was changed. Water gushed from the rock. And they praised the Lord and drank and drank. The words are magnificently true, and he deserves to be enthroned, now in the hearts of all who needs the living water, and one day soon in Zion, from whence shall flow the therapeutic grace for the healing of every ill and the ending of all agony, the full realization of the life giver's goodness. Let us never forget one thing. The water is living water because it has all the elements that make the spiritual health. Once the man of Nazareth said to his disciples, "Salt is good. Have salt in yourselves and be at peace with one another." Surely the implication is clear, that from him may be gathered that salt which is divinely good, and by whose aseptic influence corruption is halted and purity is assured. So by the water and the salt, suffering men and women are relieved of dehydration and restored to the life of the spirit.